That's Cannonball Adderley with Miles Davis and Art Blakey. I'm Michael Goldberg with Stay Human. Hey, if you were still on Daylight Savings Time, you'd be tuning in now for Jazz on America Avenue. That's coming up at 6 o'clock Standard Time. For this hour, we're winding and unwinding the clock with music, stories, and poetry to track the time, including Northern Minnesota poets Aaron Wenger, Lewis Jenkins, and Susan Hawkinson, and With This by William Shakespeare.
When I do count the clock that tells the time, and see the brave day sunk in hideous night, when I behold the violet past prime, and sable curls in silvered o'er with white, when lofty trees I see barren of leaves, which erst from heat did canopy the herd, and summer's green all girded up in sheaves, borne on the bier with white and bristly beard, then of thy beauty do I question make, that thou among the wastes of time must go, since sweets and beauties do themselves forsake, and die as fast as they see others grow. And nothing gainst time's scythe can make defence, save breed to brave him when he takes thee hence.
I've got this clock sitting on top of my bookshelf, about 2-foot-high pendulum clock, chimes the hours and the half. Did chime, I mean. It's been 3:30 on that clock for decades now. There were several hopeful trips to out-of-the-way clock repair shops, but never been fixed. I still look at it, though, every day. 3:30 is a pretty relaxing time, arms down. I grew up with that clock. I'd wake up in the night and wait for it to tell me from down the hall what time it was. Half the time, at least, it would strike only once, and I would lay there awake wondering, half past what? Let's see, if the next time it strikes only once again, then it'll either be 1 a.m. or 1:30. Night and day, that clock was as sure as the walls on the floor. Every few days, my dad would wind it up again. It was part of what was safe in my childhood, all the hours mine. Later, when I was given my first bedside alarm clock with phosphorescent paint on the hands and numbers so you could see it in the dark, I would lie awake watching it and counting my breaths, trying to keep track in and out how many in 1 minute, in three, and then shutting my eyes and counting to see if I could guess how many minutes had passed. I could count them all right, but I couldn't guess the way time changes, what it meant to be on the clock. Today, we've set back our clock an hour, but let's not kid ourselves, friends. There is no such thing as standard time. You might as well come up with something called standard consciousness. In fact, time is a lot like consciousness in a lot of ways. For one thing, nobody knows what it is. And it's never exactly the same from one person to the next, or even the same inside our own heads. Hey, my time is your time, and I'll try to be there on time, but when I get there, I'm gonna be having my own time, and so is everyone else. So, let's spend an hour outside of Central Standard Time. I'll tell you what, instead of setting our clocks back an hour, let's try setting them sideways.
It's astounding, time is fleeting, madness takes its toll, but listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control.
Yeah.
just a jump to the left.
And then a step to the right.
With your hands on your hips.
You bring your knees in tight. There is the velvet crust. It really does feel insane. Let's do the time warp again. Let's do the time warp again.
It's so dreamy. Oh, fantasy free me. So you can't see me. No, not at all. Another dimension with voyeuristic intention. Well secluded, I see all.
With a bit of a mind flip,
you're into the time slip.
And nothing can ever be the same.
You're spaced out on sensation,
like you're under sedation.
I hope you were dancing along there with the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Happy Halloween. I was killing time not long ago with my friend Charlie Parson, and he told me this story about the clock he grew up with.
When I was five, this is the second year of the Korean War. My dad had been shipped over to England to do Air Force intelligence covering the Russian Air Force, but after a year, we got to go and join him. And so we went to Fort Bragg, and I got the round of one shot on each arm, one shot on each buttock, one more shot on each buttock before we could go, which was the first time I could recall having had a shot. Then we went to England, and after being there for the first year, my parents had the opportunity to take a two-week trip onto the mainland, Europe, and they told us we could come along, but there was another whole series of shots that we'd have to take, including cholera, before we could go on to the mainland. And they painted it in such a way that my brother and I both decided we didn't want to go on to mainland Europe. And so they went on their own, and we stayed home, and that was okay. But while they were there, they got into the Black Forest, and if you go to the Black Forest, it's almost obligatory that you buy a wooden cuckoo clock. And so sure enough, they came home with a wooden cuckoo clock, and from that time on, the cuckoo clock was always up on a wall in the dining nook off the kitchen, and it had pine cone-shaped cast iron weights, and you had to pull the chain once a week, recharge it, you know, and then it would cuckoo on the hour, and at midnight, of course, it would cuckoo 12 times. And it was, you know, melodious, and I thought it was kind of quaint, but at some point, it got on my dad's nerves, and it really progressed, and finally it peaked. One time, it started cuckooing, and it was about 10 at night, and so it's going to be a long cuckoo. And in the middle of it, he got up on the bench by the table because he wasn't very tall. And when the bird came out to cuckoo, He jammed it straight right back into the cuckoo clock, and the bird never came out again. But the clock never stopped working. So we had a cuckoo clock that was there for life, and it worked, and it was fine, but it never went even. It just croaked right there. That was the end of the cuckoo.
Taj Mahal on the not-so-standard time edition of Stay Human Today. Our next timepiece comes to us from northern Minnesota writer Susan Hawkinson. She's written novels, plays, children's books, and we'll have one of her poems in this program, too. Susan Hawkinson.
Well, most people talk about stray cats showing up on their doorsteps meowing to be fed. My experience has been with stray wristwatches, appearing in unexpected places, waiting to be wound. One summer, many decades ago, a friend and I were paddling the Boundary Waters. On the third or maybe fourth afternoon, when I might have been losing track of the hour, I looked down into the glassy water from the embankment where I had perched to eat my lunch. My eyes caught an incongruous object, blinking. Then squinting at the sandy lake bottom, I knew I had spotted, where I had hoped to see a bass, a wristwatch. Fishing it out of the lake, I discovered that the watch worked with a wind or two. I stuffed it deeply into my Duluth pack, beneath my extra set of clothes. Only my imagination hounded me after that when I thought I could hear its faint tick. For the first time in my life, I had sympathy for Captain Hook. Later, on the same trip, exhausted by carrying gear across a long and strenuous portage to the wrong lake, I dropped my head, too tired to hold it up, and a second wristwatch stared back. It also worked. The BWCA is not the only sanctuary where I have been disturbed by time. On a walking trail north of Grand Rapids one fall, I was alone, enjoying the slight breeze silvering the undersides of leaves. My heartbeat and hiking stride had slowed. During this lingering late afternoon, as the sun warmed my neck and shoulders, I casually glanced ahead where the trail took a turn. A big white face on a metal stretch band lay in the middle of the walking path, tick-tocking perfectly. And once, far from the sound of loons and the ripple of water, I slouched on a kitchen chair chatting with my mother while she sorted through boxes for a rummage sale. There, among the tie tacks and cufflinks, the marble and perfume bottles, was a delicate dress wristwatch, designed first as a piece of jewelry and secondly as a watch. One of my brothers had found it when he was in elementary school. My mother had advertised in the paper trying to find its owner, but no one had claimed it. I slipped this piece of jewelry over my slim wrist and fastened it, a perfect fit of 14-karat gold, my fourth wristwatch. It has occurred to me that I try too hard to ignore time. The harder I try, the more it nuzzles me. I had this thought years ago, just before Santa appeared at an Itasca Community College Christmas party to hand out gag gifts, giving me a small box that I didn't even have to open. The only thing I didn't know was the color of the band, which turned out to be blue. Someone said, "It hasn't worked in a long time." I said, "It will work for me. They all do. It doesn't matter if I find one underwater, on a portage or walking trail, or in my mother's rummage. They all work." And of course, I had the watch running a few minutes after I arrived home from the party. Four of these five watches still lounge on my closet shelf, silent, ready to be wound. All I can hope for is that they are not dreaming of company.
That's Susan Hawkinson. We'll hear more from her coming up in just a little bit. First, this.
No money, baby. I just got an old wristwatch on my own. No money, baby. Just got an old wristwatch on my own. Yeah, just to tell me the time of the day, so I know how that I'm going on. You, darling, I'm just waiting till your money come home. Waiting on you, baby. I'm just waiting till your money come home. Just sitting here watching the time of the day with this old wristwatch on my own. Lord have mercy.
That's Lightnin' Hopkins. Watching your watch will give anybody the blues. And even though time is a different thing for everybody and different depending on where in your life you are, lying awake in a childhood bed or looking back over the decades, everybody feels it ticking, pushing, slipping away. Everyone is counting their days. When Susan Hawkinson came into the studios to tell me that story about wristwatches, she also gave us this beautiful poem.
Wanting. Sent to bed before a last light had drained the colors from the day, we whispered, my cousin and I, 10 years old, 2 weeks apart in age, until the growling of our uncle scolded us to sleep. I wanted her all to myself, my favorite childhood cousin, all day long on the river with the islands floating by. Or so it seemed that we were stationary, the little motorboat struggling hard against the current and the high diagonal waves. But of course, we were not stationary. July passed for June, as did August, and 11 years for 10, and likewise 12, until the whirl of time took hold of us and spun us off to Iowa and Maine. My childhood eyes knew far in advance what was coming. On the nights after we fell silent and she had slipped off to sleep, I would look out at the dewy grass, blurred by the new darkness, smell the damp air, and wander toward our future, where the hazy silhouettes of grown-up women tapped their fingertips together one last time and then surrendered their shared past forever.
Susan Hawkinson.
Lying in my bed, I hear the clock tick and think of you, turning in circles. Confusion is nothing new. Flashback.
If you fall, I will catch you.
Underwood, Clock Don't Stop. Eva Cassidy before that. We're broadcasting on KAXE-KBXE, streaming at KAXE.org. Thanks to the listeners in northern Minnesota and in time zones all over for supporting the service by becoming members of Northern Community Radio. Thanks also to the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which supports this and other local programs. Today on Stay Human, we're setting our clock sideways 1 hour. I've got time on my mind. And coming up, physicist Aaron Wenger tries to explain to us what time actually is. I do know that I'm glad to be back on standard time, as it's called. We'll get first light around 6:30 tomorrow morning, which makes it a lot easier to get out of bed. How much time you figure you saved over the past few months of daylight savings? Seems like no matter what you save, there's never enough. I've always liked that movie effect where our main character stops time somehow and is able to move about in a world where everyone else is a statue. Or even better, where everyone else is in slow motion. There's a beautiful little scene at the end of the remake of Bedazzled. Watch the original with Dudley Moore. The remake was a dud, except for the final scene in which the devil and God are playing chess at an outdoor cafe. The square is full of people zipping by frantically. The film is way speeded up, except there's a few. One here, there's another, a couple more over there, enlightened ones, walking at normal pace with a bemused expression on their face. We all feel like that sometimes, don't we? When we're in the groove, what's everybody rushing around like this for? Too bad I can't slow it down at will. Lucky sometimes we can. We've already set the clocks back an hour, but coming up next, we're going to set the clock back a whole lot more than that. My friend Jeff Weintraub has been reading The Oldest Clock There Is and thinking about deep time.
When you handle stone for a while, it starts to feel plastic. You can feel your fingertips pressing into it. It's really just your fingertips yielding that you feel, but because you're stronger and familiar with hefting stone, it feels as if you're compressing the incompressible. Like when palming a basketball, you are a worker of small miracles, a freshly minted demigod with limited dominion over the beasts of gravity. But for all those intimations of omnipotence, the pile at the start of each day's wall building was a classroom of middle schoolers, defiant, impenetrable, daring to be moved and not moving until I moved them. I tiptoe to the margins and cut loose a couple of suitable outliers, hoist them aloft and let them settle in my hands like a bouncing bathroom scale, noting fault lines and features of color or texture, and rotating them to find the best face and fit for this moment of the wall. And at those moments, just before it became mine, I sensed the stone's supreme indifference to serving a fabricator's purpose or lying beneath the surface of the earth forever, whatever that is. Because as it is, the human era is just a shudder in a stone's existence. Stone is time incarnate. It has always been here. It is the here. From the formation of the earth's crust from gases and gravity a little over 4 billion years ago, until a few billion years from now when the sun starts running out of hydrogen to burn and eats us up. Stone is the embodiment of time's passage, the proof and the product of forces acting over hundreds of millions of years in cycles of sedimentation and erosion, the process of lifting up and grinding down at the rate of a few millimeters to centimeters a year, that is, slower than fingernails grow, comprising what the geologists call deep time. We typically don't know more than 2 generations younger and 2 generations older than our own, maybe 3, rarely 4. Civilization, such as it is, has been traced back some 6,000 years. Little wonder that the concept of 1 million years, let alone 10 million and 1,000 million, is incomprehensible. Save to say, that's a very long time. As John McPhee, the noted nonfiction writer who's devoted 3 books to geology and geologists, writes, the human mind may not have evolved enough to be able to comprehend deep time. It may only be able to measure it. You can speak of periods and eras and eons, but you have to resort to metaphor to make any sense of the insignificance of our time on this beyond ancient rock. Mark Twain referred to the span of human history as the skin of paint at the summit of the Eiffel Tower. Mr. McPhee imagines the age of the earth as the distance between your arms spread wide, or in a single stroke with a medium-grain nail file at the tip of your finger, you could eradicate human history. On a recent trip to the Grand Canyon, we saw stone writ in great horizontal bands of time spanning the canyon, the beginning of the story 1 mile below the rim at the canyon floor 1¾ billion years ago, the so-called basement stone of the late Precambrian era. And above, nearly 40 major sedimentary rock layers, ranging in age up to about 200 million years old near the rim. Limestone, shale, sandstone, each layer representing the geology of its many million years period. Most layers were deposited in warm, shallow seas near the shore of what was Western North America. Some include both marine and terrestrial sediments compressed to become limestone and sandstone, including lithified sand dunes from an extinct desert, some the displaced, eroded scrapings of mountains that rose and fell. Hiking into the canyon, we descended through millennia on trails cut through time, each step taking us closer to cosmic bedrock. Slowly, very slowly. So stone envelops us like time. No other substance comes to the present, having traveled such a long journey. No other substance save water is so ubiquitous, takes so many forms, abides so definitively. On our most recent trip to North Wales, we hiked past volcanic lakes and crags, along glacial moraines of mineral debris, over lithified volcanic ash and folds of igneous rock. We explored towering castles of great stone blocks, decades in the building. We walked alongside dry stone walls that bordered lanes and homesteads and crisscrossed boulder-strewn grazing fields. We drove past the somber-dressed gray stones of stolid Welsh homes with their impeccable dark slate roofs quarried from pits that the Romans dug. We saw tumbled boulders cleaving fast rivers and roaring waterfalls, ancient stone burial chambers and cairns, stone circles, great standing stones and monuments like the great blocks of bluestone quarried incredibly 180 miles from their ultimate resting place in Stonehenge, the very ground beneath our feet from pre-Cambrian times serving thousands of uses under the sun. A poet of the mid-20th century, João Cabral de Melo Neto, drew inspiration from his birthplace, Pernambuco, an arid backland of northeast Brazil where severe poverty and persistent drought created an austere poetry with the elemental and eternal properties of stone. Stone will always instruct us, he says, whether we know it or not. Education by Stone. An education by stone, through lessons, to learn from the stone, to go to it often, to catch its level, impersonal voice. By its choice of words, it begins its classes. The lesson in morals, the stone's cold resistance to flow, to flowing, to being hammered. The lesson in poetics, its concrete flesh. In economics, how to grow dense compactly. Lessons from the stone, from without to within, dumb primer, for the routine speller of spells. Another education by stone, in the backlands, from within to without in pre-didactic place. In the backlands, stone does not know how to lecture, and even if it did, would teach nothing. You don't learn the stone there. There, the stone, born stone, penetrates the soul.
Don't leave me here alone.
Leon Russell, words and music for Spirit and Courage. On today's show, we're setting our clocks back, because what's an hour either way? Not the same as it was yesterday, not the same to a child as to an elder. What's time to a rock? Up next, Duluth-based poet Lewis Jenkins. His prose poems always see things at a slant, and I had never thought before about what time might mean to a member of the species Asteroidea.
Starfish. It seems like starfish don't do anything, but actually they move along at a rate of about 60 feet per hour. A starfish will eat anything that moves slower than it does, which excludes a great number of dishes from its diet. A starfish is all arms and appetite. It has no brain. Yet in spite of this, time-lapse photography has shown that the starfish maintains an active social life. So in these regards, the starfish is like many of the people you know.
Lewis Jenkins. Coming up, I ask physics teacher Aaron Wenger to give me a scientific explanation of time. But first, he gave me this prose poem, The Barn.
Damn old barn was built out of my granddad's blood. Built 3 feet longer and 3 feet higher than any other barn, any other life in Vernon Township, Ohio. 600 feet of double-walled foundation dug up, laid up out of glacier stones that had been casually dropped along the Ohio moraine by an uncaring glacier when the Shawnee had been not heard from yet. Much later, the Shawnee worked those stones into grinders, axes, and the hide scrapers that made their lives. Centuries later, Granddad laid those stones double with a 6-inch airspace separating the foundation walls. No frost ever breached those walls, and no frost ever stopped his dreaming, seeing a lifetime in the Ohio haze of summer. Spent 2 winters cutting and hewing shag bark hickory into timbers for the barn. Timber spanning 60 feet, holding up hay lofts with their 12 by 12 mortise tenoned strength. Not a nail in the whole structure. Used to run along those beams playing hide-go-seek. Used to sneak along them at night and steal away baby pigeons that Grandma made in the squab. Barn stood there along a Shawnee Creek for 100 years, holding cows, pigs, chickens, children, and the dreams of madmen. Summer 012, the ghosts of the Shawnee tired of it. Took it back into the forest in an Ohio thunderstorm. Cut through the hickory like a knife in the water of time. Ah, well, the Shawnee were owed. I stood beside those busted up walls, listened to the moan of history, sung by the wind through cracked boards, listened to the gone away Shawnee song of Granddad's barn.
Aaron Wenger is a regular contributor to our program. He's also our longtime staff physicist, and so I turn to him for the fundamentals. Professor, what is time?
Well, I got to admit right off the top that I don't know. I know how I can use it in a myriad of equations that keep track of things. I can keep track of a spacecraft from low Earth orbit to Mars. I can make course adjustments and all that with equations of which there are 4 primary variables. Length, breadth, and height, measured from some coordinate system, and the other's time, measured in some way, by a watch, by an atomic clock, by the beats of my heart. I used to measure time in a darkroom when I was really into photography. As you develop film or something when the lights had to be completely off, I used to measure it by the beats of my heart. But I don't know fundamentally what it is. I have a lot of predictive power of linking event A to event B to event C and so on with equations involving time. When I begin to get doubts about it, and this started with me probably 30 or 40 years ago, I discovered that the equations were very, very good for describing changes in a system. Changes in the state of an atom or a molecule or even an individual particle of physics. Changes in the state of what an electron cloud looked like and how an electron cloud behaved around whatever, a hydrogen or an oxygen or whatever atom. That the equations were very good at that. if they didn't work so good, you wouldn't be able to use your cell phone from a satellite 23,000 miles above the earth to a tower to another tower and winding up in your ear. We know how to do that. But when that atom indeed changes from state C to state B or to state D, whatever it does, there's a whole bunch of possibilities open. When that happens, there's no history linking those changes. It appears as though there's no time. The change occurs, and it simply becomes a different entity. And that began to bug me. In classical old physics, we had a firm belief that events were causal, that they were tracked by a history, and our equations involving time helped us do that. In quantum physics, the events are not linked by history. It simply becomes another entity. What the equations do allow me to predict the probabilities of the different changes taking place, and that's great stuff. But it began to make me wonder, do I really know what that variable means? The other thing interesting to me about time is how fundamentally flawed we humans are to be able to sense it. We sense smells better than we sense time. And good Lord, your dog does 100 times better job at sensing smells than you do. But time, you do have something happen in less than about a 20th of a second, and it does not happen for you or I. We see the beginning and we see the end, but we don't see the stuff in between. If you have something that occurs over geological or cosmological time periods, this planet having been here for about 4.5 billion years, we comfort ourselves with stories that say that isn't true. It doesn't matter where you get them from. It's like comfort food because it's hard to wrap your head around 4.5 or something billion years. The Rocky Mountains that you'll fly over the next time you go to Oregon or someplace weren't there 200 million years ago. That's hard to wrap a head around. So as the creatures that we are, it's impossible. We can't process the information fast enough in our minds. We can't process the information quickly enough to see really rapid events. And we seem to have a fundamental mind block or something of recognizing time in very large blocks of it. That's a strange little interval that we occupy. Our notion of our own existence is really crammed down to these, whatever, perhaps 100 years that you're lucky enough maybe to have.
So tell me about those rocks that you brought in.
I call them my props for this one. They're two black granite, I believe. They're pretty dense, heavy for their size. Two black rocks from my either great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather's fields there in Ohio. They almost certainly came from a set of people who were called the Shawnee. They were sort of the last in line of the original inhabitants of that region of Ohio, Delaware, Wyandotte, a bunch of other people who also occupied that same period, up by Lake Erie, the Erie folks, Huron, and so on. And the Ojibwe. Ojibwe were as far south and east as the Lake Erie of the Great Lakes. These things are beautiful tools. The one, almost certainly a hide scraper, still has a perfectly good edge. I could tan a deer hide with this thing. And it's a polished edge. It's a beautiful piece of work. It also has a kind of groove at one side of it that your thumb fits into nicely to push across a hide as you're taking the fat and flesh off of it. The other one has a beautifully constructed groove about two-thirds of the way up to the top. It's a sort of oblate sphere with a flat top and a flat bottom, almost certainly a hammer stone for a whole myriad useful tasks that a person would do. I look at these things, and it's like a signal to me, a path to me, from their time to mine. And I like the feeling of it. I wish I had known them. more personally than I ever did. Supposedly my great-great-grandfather, who lived at the edge of what was called the Black Swamp in Ohio, it was as the white settlers flooded in. It was sort of the last refuge for original people that didn't at least just assimilate into the white culture coming in. The Shawnee were almost more of a plains people, possibly more similar to Blackfeet than to eastern tribes of folks. They were, from what I read anyhow, not exactly interested in farming and so on. They were more of the hunter-gatherer. Delaware and other people in Ohio were had peach orchards, for heaven's sakes. Not so much the Shawnee. And when things really were starting to go bad, around the era of the War of 1812, the Shawnee apparently used to capture white folks, take them up to what's now Fremont, Ohio, up by Lake Erie, and get ransom for them from either the Brits or from the French. Any rate, they scared the bejeebers out of my great-granddad and great-great-granddad's family. When I was a child, it was still scary for the people who raised me to drive on the dirt winding road that went through the Black Swamp. It was a place of fear for them. These things take me to a different place. These tools that these folks crafted with stones that they almost certainly traded for far away from their home in Ohio. There is no black granite around there. These stones take me to a different place of seeing the world through a set of eyes, a culture very, very unlike mine, but doing the same things that I've been interested in doing all my life. Different tools, different construction, but the same idea these people were doing. I find that somehow comforting. It really was a link across whatever time is from their world to our world. It really was a pathway that us kids really enjoyed. I'll say one other thing about these tools that we discovered. For the most part, you know, we were children, 6, 7, 8, whatever years old. And so we had about the appreciation level of an 8-year-old boy. But occasionally, I have some, we would come across a implement made so beautifully that what you wanted to do was meet the person who had done that. These that I've got in my hand here are working tools. I've got some that had to be an example of someone saying, look what I can do, because they're way too thin to be a working tool, I think, way too big. You wouldn't put this on a projectile point and expect it to go through anything. It's got too large a surface area. They seem to me be a statement. I can do this. I would have liked to met that person.
That's Aaron Wenger. He couldn't really help me out much this time with understanding the science of it, but he sure knows how to time travel. Thanks for spending your time with me and with Lewis Jenkins, Susan Hawkinson, Jeff Weintraub, and Charlie Parson. I'm Michael Goldberg, here for Stay Human every week at this time. We started out this hour with a dance number, Let's Do the Time Warp, but our analytics are showing that hardly any listeners were actually doing the dance. I don't know, maybe you didn't have time right then, or maybe you weren't too sure about trying to learn a new dance, jump to the right, whatever. You don't have to dance to it if you don't want to, but the show is called Stay Human, and if that's what you're doing, keep doing it.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on and join me, huh? We'll have some fun when the clock's back. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Well, when the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4, if the band slows down, we'll yell for more. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Yeah.
Rocky Mountain's hot.